the field turns for home.
They're at the top of the stretch.
Top of the stretch.
They're into the stretch.
And here they come into the final furlong.
Final furlong.
Final furlong.
Into the final furlong.
They go inside the final furlong.
This is the final furlong on HRRN Live.
HRRN Live.
It's Trainer Talk Wednesday. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Well, good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, our customary Wednesday night feature, talking with trainers from all over the country over the past several months, and it's been an awful lot of fun. We do welcome you to the program if you are just joining us on Sirius Channel 93, and for all of you who have been with us on XM 209 with Chad Summers and Sean Feld for our live racing coverage over the course of the last 3 hours. Welcome back to the program. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, Pontiff of the Pick Four, in studio in Lexington, Kentucky, and ready for a couple of really fun visits on the show tonight.
Yeah, really looking forward to it. It's kind of a New York show this evening.
We're in a New York state of mind. Is that what you're trying to say?
Oh, I love that. Love listening to that at the end of Saratoga every day. It's like, kind of like the highlight of the day.
Somebody who is always in a New York state of mind is trainer Gary Contessa. He is going to be our first guest on Trainer Talk tonight. He will be followed by trainer Tom Bush in the second half of the program, so stay tuned. But without further ado, we do bring in Gary Contessa, a man who has conditioned 2024 career winners. They have earned $64 million in purses. And Gary, nice enough to spend a little time with us here today. Gary, thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me. Glad to be on.
Yeah, happy to have you on the program. Looking forward to hearing your story and hearing how you got hooked on racing. Where did it all start for Gary Contessa?
Man, it all started, it's kind of a weird thing. I think it probably goes back to a past life, but I grew up on Long Island, and my mother drove a school bus. My father was a mailman who thought I was going to follow in his footsteps. So, but anytime there was a horse, anything, I had to have it. Since I'm as far back as I can remember, if there was a pony ride or whatever, I had to be around horses. I had an attraction to horses that was, like, you know, unparalleled in my family, because I really don't come from a horse family. So it started when I was very young. I rode horses. And then I figured out when I got to be about 8 or 9 years old that I only lived 15 minutes from Roosevelt Raceway. So I'd ride my bicycle there and beg those guys to let me do anything for nothing. I would clean stalls. I would put bandages on horses. Then I graduated to jogging horses and riding horses. And then I figured out that 15 minutes in the other direction was Hempstead Lake State Park Riding Academy. So I made a deal over there where I would clean 50 stalls, and they would give me an hour of free riding time. So I did that every Saturday and Sunday morning. After I got done at Roosevelt, I would ride to Hempstead and ride horses at Hempstead Lake State Park.
Wow, 50 stalls.
And, you know, in those days,
for an hour's worth of time.
If you've ever seen a riding academy, horses were in straight stalls. So all that you saw was their butt and a big pile of horse poop. So you would just go right down the line, right behind the horse, and clean up those big piles from that one spot. So, I mean, I was picking up like these 50, 60-pound piles. And so I got strong early on in life. I got strong pretty quick doing that.
Did they give you a pitchfork, or did you have to do it by hand?
you had to do it with a broom and a shovel.
Oh, wow.
So it was definitely different, let's put it that way.
Well, Gary, you had me at the word mailman, because both my father and grandfather were both letter carriers for several years. So I come from a long line of mailmen. And just curious, if your dad, you said you weren't from a racing family, but if he ever took you to the track or spent any time at the track with you?
Absolutely not. My dad was old school Italian, and he would have beat the daylights out of me if he knew I went to the track. So we didn't tell him things. And the thing about my father is he didn't look for things. So he was like one of those, you know, don't look, don't tell, you know, kind of guys. So everything I did, my mother knew about, but I would never tell my father. And I had an uncle who was like another hardcore Italian guy who smoked cigars that were like 2 feet long, and that guy used to hang out at Belmont Park. So I would start hanging out with him, and that's where my first Belmont Park experience came. But my first racetrack experience was Roosevelt Raceway. I mean, you know, going there at night, riding my bicycle over there, sneaking in under the fence. I mean, Roosevelt Raceway, to me, was the bomb. And then I graduated and discovered Belmont Park, which once I discovered thoroughbred racing, I was hooked.
I don't think people realize how hard it is on kids from big cities that love horses like you did. And the same with me. I'm from L.A. And the only place you could ever see a live horse was at the track.
Right. And because there wasn't much happening. But you know something? The track was, when you get to the track and you're that wide-eyed kid, you're like, oh, my God, horses, this is incredible. And then you start watching TV. And you got to remember, when I'm watching TV, there's only three channels on the TV. And we only got the big races on TV, you know. And what you would see, Woody Stevens, Mac Miller, you know, the cream of the crop. We had the antics of Johnny Campo when he was on the Triple Crown Trail. Stuff like that. That's what I got to grow up with when I was a kid. And I was so enamored with horse racing. I would have worked for nothing, believe me. If they would just feed me, I was happy working at the racetrack.
So you were just a fan of the sport and knew all along that this was something you needed to be part of in some capacity.
I'll tell you what, I left high school and I had a shot. I was a pretty decent kid in high school, and I had a shot to work for European American Bank. And as a matter of fact, I did take that job, and I did that stint for about a year with them. But I knew in my heart, every weekend I went to the racetrack, worked for free, did whatever I could. And one day I woke up and said, you know what? I want to follow the road less traveled. I want to be a horse trainer. This is what's in my heart. And this is what I'm going to do. So I quit this opportunity with European American Bank, didn't follow the opportunity that my father wanted to give me. And you know how, I don't know if you know Italian fathers, they're like, if they give you an opportunity and you don't follow in it, the old school ones, they stop talking to you. You're like, what do you mean you're not going to follow in my footsteps? I'm giving you this great opportunity. So my father was not happy by my choice of careers at that time. And I'm not sure I was either. I went to the racetrack. It was culture shock for me. I got yelled at. I got screamed at. I decided to be a hot walker and work my way up from the bottom. And I just gave up everything I knew in life and said, I want to make it on the racetrack. And I didn't take no for an answer, and I stayed at the track all day long. I was making $53 a week working for David Sazer at Aqueduct, and I knew this is what I wanted, and I just was like a sponge. I wanted to talk to the vets. I worked for the vets for free when I got done working my job. I went over to the racing office and would talk to guys like Lenny Hale and guys like that. I wanted to know everything I could know about this business.
I got to say, it's a good thing you didn't go into negotiations, because 50 stalls for 1 hour and then a week's worth of work for $56. It's probably good you didn't work for the union or something.
Let me tell you something. The racetrack was not known for paying people a lot of money. The only people that made money were trainers. You know, everybody else, when I was an assistant trainer, I worked my way up. I became a groom for Jimmy Pecou. Back in the days when he had Palm Hut and Fall Aspen and all the Joseph Roebling horses, and quickly moved up to be his foreman, and then equally quickly moved up to be his assistant trainer. And, I mean, a lot of good horses. We won the Travers Willow Hour, and I just wanted to keep improving. And when I was a kid, if I saw Woody Stevens or Mac Miller or one of those guys do something that I thought was a really unusual move, like Mac Miller one day, I saw him put this gadget on a horse's face in a race. It looked like a net of some sort. And I went over to his barn the next day, and I knocked on his door, and I shook his hand. I said, I'm Gary Contessa, and I want to be a trainer, and I have a question for you. Why'd you do that with that horse yesterday? And he put his arm around me, and he explained it to me, and I was like, wow, this is great. And then I tried it with Woody Stevens, and then I tried it with Johnny Campo. And before you know it, everybody on the racetrack, Laz, Frank Martin, everybody knew who I was, because I was the kid who went barn to barn asking trainers why they did stuff. Everybody kind of liked it. I think I was probably the only guy who was doing it at that time. And I just kept moving up through the ranks. And Stanley Huff hired me away from Jimmy Pacu as an assistant trainer. And then when I was there, we had the Harbor View Farm Horses, so I worked as an assistant trainer for Laz Barrera. And ultimately, one day I'm riding by, I rode horses too, and one day I'm riding by the clocker stand at Belmont, and Frank Martin, and believe me, everybody feared Frank Martin at this time. He was leading trainer in New York. You know, he had those steel blue eyes. He was always screaming at people. He said, "You, I want to talk to you when you get done." And I went over to I went over to Frank Martin's barn. I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I got too close to one of his horses, you know, with my horse, and this guy's going to scream at me. But when Frank Martin said, "I want you to come to my office," you did it. So I went to his office, and he says, "How much does that guy pay you?" He says, "I've been watching you." And I think I was making $3 or $3.50 a week. He says, "I double your pay. You come work for me." And I ultimately ended up spending 5 years with Frank Martin, and it was the best 5 years I ever spent as far as a learning experience goes. Frank Martin was the greatest mentor I ever had.
What were some of those things that you took away from working with Frank?
Well, first of all, if you survived the Frank Martin school, you could take a beating and keep going. I screamed, no matter who did something wrong in that barn, it was my fault. But he gave me some mettle. He gave me some courage, and he gave me strength because I could handle everything he threw at me and keep going. But Frank Martin was the kind of guy where he could look at a horse from 30 yards away and turn to me, and he could say, "That horse's left shoulder is bothering him, or his right foot is bothering him, or x-ray that horse's right knee, or x-ray that horse's hind left ankle." And I'll be damned, every single time he was right. But you had to know, this was a learning experience for me, you had to know when it was okay to ask a question to Frank and when it wasn't. Because 90% of the time, Gary Contessa could not say, "Gee, how did you notice that, Mr. Martin?" But there was a time when I could. And when that time was right, that guy would teach me stuff and tell me why he did things. And it was trial by fire with Frank Martin. You watched what he did and you learned. But he wasn't a teacher. He wasn't a guy who puts his arm around you and says, "Come here, I want to show you something." That never happened. He did things, and you either learned or you died trying, and that's how that business worked. But I learned because I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn more than anybody I've ever met on the racetrack. I gave up my personal life. I gave up every aspect of my personal life because of this dream to become a horse trainer.
Was that when Sigmund Sumner had all the claiming horses?
Sigmund Sumner. And during that time, what was the name? There was another stable that came to Frank, and then ultimately Harborview Farm hired Frank. Harborview Farm was in turmoil. They had just hired Manny Gilman as their manager, and nobody liked them. So Stanley Huff quit, Lefty Nickerson quit, Scotty Schulhofer quit, Laz Barrera quit, and ultimately Frank Martin was another stop. And that year we had Outstanding Lee, who won the Breeders' Cup, and we had a ton of Harborview horses. So I actually came full circle because I knew a lot of those Harborview horses as two-year-olds when I worked with Stanley. So, you know, Frank Martin ultimately ended up with 50% summer horses. Oh, it was all of the horses, but about 50% of our barn was Viola Summer. Sigmund had died. And 50% of our barn was Harborview Farm horses, and that was the year, I think it was 1984, that we won the Breeders' Cup with Outstanding Lee, and we went on to win the Starlet that year, too, with Outstanding Lee in California.
Trainer Gary Contessa joining us on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is the show that trainers listen to, and certainly enjoying this visit here with Gary this evening. Gary, what led you to eventually decide to make that decision to go out on your own?
Well, when I took the job with Frank Martin, I thought I was ready to go on my own that day. And I realized by working with Frank how much I didn't know. There's no doubt we wouldn't be talking on this phone today if I hadn't spent that 4 or 5 years with Frank Martin. There's no question about it. That guy made me a trainer. But I knew that I wasn't far from going out on my own. So I actually told Frank that the day was going to come when I was going to go out on my own, and he kept saying, yeah, yeah, yeah. And in 1984, he had a tremendous overflow of horses, and he sent me to Monmouth Park with mostly Harborview Farm horses. And he was the trainer. I was his assistant. But we went in there, and we won a ton of races. And then we went to Meadowlands that fall, and we won a ton of races. And, you know, I was there, and I was the guy. Frank rarely came over to Monmouth, and I reported directly to Frank. I mean, I was his assistant. I take no credit for any of that. But I did make some connections. And one of those people was Elizabeth Taylor. And it wasn't the Elizabeth Taylor. This Elizabeth Taylor directed pornography. She was a porno director of movies. She made movies all over the place, and it was all these X-rated movies, but she owned horses. And she said to me, next year at Monmouth, I would like you to be my trainer. And she had a pretty good claiming stable of about, you know, 15, 20 horses. And I said, I'd love to do that. So when the Meadowlands was over in December, I went to Frank Martin, and I said, I'm going to leave you in May, and I'm going to go on my own in Monmouth Park. I made a connection. I'm going to train for this lady in Monmouth Park. I'm going to go on my own. And that was going to be May of 1985. And Frank spent January, February, March, April, and May trying to talk me out of it. And, you know, he put a lot of money on the table. I could have been a very rich assistant trainer, but I wanted to go on my own. So in May of 1985, I applied for stalls in New York. They laughed at me. I applied for stalls at Monmouth Park, and they said, you know, and they welcomed me to come to Monmouth Park, and I took Elizabeth Taylor's horses and went to Monmouth Park and had a great run. And incredibly, once all these trainers that I had been bugging all these years, Johnny Campo, Bobby Roboto, Mac Miller, Woody, everybody that got to know me because of I was the guy who never stopped asking him questions. I probably drove him crazy a few times, but I never stopped asking him questions. All of those guys supported me as a trainer when I went on my own to Monmouth. So I got, you know, 5 or 10 horses for Johnny Campo. You know, guys would call me, hey, I got 2 horses coming in, 3 horses coming in. And before you know it, by the end of the Monmouth meeting, I had about 50 horses in training at Monmouth Park for various New York guys. And actually did pretty well. You know, I think I was 3rd or 4th leading trainer at Monmouth in my first year there. We had a really good run, and I claimed a lot of horses and had a lot of horses for these other guys, and that was how I got my start. And the big break that I got was that fall, Tony Bardero, who had the best private job in New Jersey, announced his retirement, and Brightview Farm was taking applications for a trainer. I sent him my resume, and they had got like 50 resumes. I did an interview with them, and that January, I was named trainer for Brightview Farm, which was unbelievable, which was 40 of the best Jersey-bred older horses in the country, as well as another 42-year-olds coming in. One owner, I got paid a paycheck. I didn't have to worry about bills. I got a percentage, and I went on to win pretty much every Jersey-bred stake there was in the following years. And it was just a tremendous, tremendous opportunity to be a private trainer in only my second year of training horses.
Nothing beats that kind of a job where you don't have any worries whatsoever, and you can just concentrate on the horses.
And the horses that they handed me, the older horses were pretty much already accomplished stake horses, and the younger horses were all their brothers and sisters. So it was just a great job. And, you know, I remember probably my second year of training for Brightview Farm. They have the Jersey Bred Breeder Awards at the end of the year, and it was 9 categories, and we won 8 of them. They must have hated me. Looking back in retrospect, knowing how I feel sometimes, I'm sure they hated me. But I won, you know, I had the best 2-year-old filly, best 2-year-old colt, best 3-year-old, I had just smashing Owens Troop, Bill Wheeler, Derby Hat, some great, great stake horses for Brightview Farm.
Gary, you mentioned when you first started training, you applied for stalls in New York, and they laughed at you, and that's how you ended up in New Jersey at Monmouth Park. What eventually led to you being able to open that door and get stalls at NYRA?
Like anything in life, when you have something that people want, people reach out to you. And it's like if you're a jockey agent that everybody hates, but you got the best jockey, people are going to love you. And that's and when I applied for stalls in New York in the 80s was sons, fathers handed this business down to sons, pretty much. It wasn't like it is now where names, you know, where a guy like Rudy Rodriguez could be an exercise rider for Richard Dutrow and go on his own and have horses in New York. That wouldn't have happened in the 80s. In the 80s, you had to be established. You had to be somebody, or you had to be related to somebody. So I applied for stalls. There was no shot. But after, I'm going to say about 1990, 1991, after five or six incredibly solid years for Brightview Farm, I would bring the Brightview horses here during the winter, and we had great winter runs with those horses. And Mr. Connolly, John Connolly, who owned Brightview Farm, passed away. And immediately they were going to disperse all the Brightview horses, and I went from having 60 or 80 great horses to nothing. And I went to the Kentucky Derby that year with nothing. And who do I sit down next to? Mrs. Payson. And Mrs. Payson happens to be looking for a trainer at Monmouth. And I had just lost all my horses, but everybody knew who I was because I was on a very good run at the time. And Mrs. Payson sent me 20, 25 horses, and I reestablished myself almost immediately as a public trainer at Monmouth. And at the end of that year, New York was now, you know, reaching out to me. Hey, why don't you come here? Why don't you think about coming here in the spring? Why don't you come here? And the spring, I would say, we continued to winter through about 1993. Spring of 1993, I moved all of them to New York and stayed.
Trainer Gary Contessa, our special guest on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You know, one thing that was in the spotlight throughout this year's Triple Crown run was your fellow New Yorker, Mike Rapoli. And
right.
He stated right before the Belmont Stakes that that's the race he wanted to win more than any other race, the Kentucky Derby included. Being a New Yorker, Gary, would you echo those sentiments? Is it more rewarding to win a big race in New York than anywhere else?
You know, I read that, but I don't think too many people are going to tell you that the Kentucky Derby isn't the biggest horse for anybody to win. Let's face it, the whole world is watching the Kentucky Derby. I love winning in New York, love to win the Travers, love to win the Belmont Stakes. But if you're asking me to name one race that I would love to win, I think you're going to get a very high group of New York trainers who tell you it's the Kentucky Derby. Let's face it, that's the big race on the big stage. And I love the Belmont Stakes. But Mike Rapoli, he's a different kind of guy. He's all about New York. I'm born and raised in New York, and I'm all about New York, and I root for the Mets, and Mike roots for the Mets, but he takes it to the next extreme. I really believe what he's saying. He would love to win the Belmont Stakes more than anything, and I think that's a fantastic race to win. I'd like to win it, but let's face it. I mean, the Kentucky Derby is really, you know, 9 out of 10 trainers are going to tell you they want to win the Kentucky Derby. That is the big stage. That race that day, it's like the whole world stops doing what they're doing and turns the TV on to see what happens in the Kentucky Derby.
Gary, just about a couple of minutes left before we do have to wrap up this interview. We could spend another half an hour with you easily. It's been so enjoyable. But just curious, you talked about you talking with other trainers and how other people would embrace you because you had that passion and that desire to eventually become a trainer. Have you had any young kids come up to you and say, hey, Gary, I want to be a trainer. Can you help me?
You know, I'm going to tell you, probably one of the most disappointing things in my 30 years of training horses is I've never met a young guy that has the passion that I had. And maybe that's a sign of the times. Maybe that's a sign of how difficult this business can be, how young guys can make a lot more money working a lot less hours. But I haven't met people like that. But I have made quite a few riders. And anytime anybody asks me anything, I stop and I give them my time and my attention because of the people who gave it to me. And I could be in the grandstand and a kid asks me something, or somebody asks me for a job, I will always give somebody a chance. Or a rider asks me for a job that wants to become a rider, I am always willing to teach somebody. But I really haven't met a guy who wanted to be a trainer as much as I wanted to be a trainer. I just haven't met that person. And I wish. I've given a lot of guys shots who have failed. And I just haven't found anybody. People find it very difficult. This is a tough business. This is a business where you wake up at 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning, and you get done at 8 o'clock. It's a business where the divorce rate is probably twice what anything else is, because you have to give up a lot to make it in this business. This is a business where a horse gets sick and you're heading out to a Broadway show, and the show gets put, you know, you don't go to the show, you go back to the barn. And, you know, this is one of those businesses where it's not for everybody. And to answer your question, I just haven't met that guy. In my 30 years of doing this, I have yet to meet that guy. Met a lot of promising guys. Kelly Breen came through my barn, but I didn't teach him to be a trainer. But he came through my barn, and he definitely spent a little time in the Contessa school, and then he moved on to the Perkins school. And I've had guys that came through my barn that went on to be something, but I just haven't met a guy that had the passion that I had.
Well, Gary, you're going to have to promise to join us again up the road on Trainer Talk. There's so much more we could talk to you about, and the horses you've had come through your care. A lot of other things we can get into, but we are about out of time tonight. We really, really appreciate it. Folks can go to your website to read more. It's GaryContessa.com. And, Gary, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure. I'm always available to you guys. Thanks.
Thanks, Gary.
Well, really fun interview.
Yeah.
With Gary.
We definitely could have gone longer with him. He's a man that definitely embraces the passion of our sport.
Yeah, he certainly does, as does our second guest, trainer Tom Bush. He's coming up on the other side of this break. This is Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Attention horsemen, are you getting the most out of your equine athlete? All natural EPO equine could be the answer. EPO equine is the most potent blood builder on the market. Top trainers like Scott Lake and Steve Margolis are reporting dramatic improvements in their horses. Easy to use and clinically tested, EPO equine is the product your horses need for speed, strength, and stamina right out of the gate. Call 215-501-6880 or visit epoequine.com. Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair strips' gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair strips.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
This is Daily Racing Form's Dan Ullman with some big news about DRF bets. Thousands of players like you have already made the switch to DRF bets, and now there's an even bigger reason for you to join. Free DRF PPs. That's right. For the first time ever, get free Daily Racing Form PPs when you wager with DRF bets. These are the DRF past performances you know and love, and DRF bets is the only place you can get them free. So why wager anywhere else? With DRF bets, you'll get the best sign-up bonus in the business, free guides and analysis from DRF's top handicappers, breaking news, analysis, and wagering on the go with DRF and DRF Bets Mobile, one-click multi-ticket wagers with DRF Ticketmaker, and now free Daily Racing Form PPs. Only one place gives you the PPs you prefer when you wager, DRF Bets. Join today and wager with the most trusted name in racing. And if you sign up right now, you'll get a $125 cash bonus. Find out more at drf.com/bets. That's drf.com/bets.
HRRN proudly brings you Thoroughbred Racing's fastest day, the Summit of Speed.
live from Calder Casino and Racecourse. Join our Eclipse Award-winning broadcast team Saturday, July 6th for live coverage of the Grade 1 Princess Rooney Handicap, the Grade 2 Smile Sprint Handicap, and more. Who will punch their ticket to the Breeders' Cup? Tune in to find out. The Summit of Speed, Saturday, July 6th, only on HRRN. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday on the Final Furlong on HRRN Live.
Welcome back to Trainer Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is the show that trainers listen to. And one of those trainers is trainer Tom Bush, and he joins us now for the second half of this Trainer Talk show. If you missed any portion of our interview with Gary Contessa in the first half of the program, you can visit our website later on for a podcast at horseracingradio.net. Listen at your leisure and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. Tom, thanks so much for taking a few minutes to be with us tonight.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Yeah, happy to have you with us. And Tom Bush, a guy who is a native of Indianapolis, of all places, not exactly a horse racing hotbed. Tom, how do you get hooked on racing growing up in Indianapolis?
Well, I had a friend in high school whose father raced quarter horses, and just on the outskirts of Indianapolis, they had a farm. So did a lot of hanging out there, and then I went to work on a horse farm right out of high school in Ocala, Florida, and I've been doing it ever since.
Which farm was that?
It was called Someday Farm. It was owned by Frank and Lois Myers, two wonderful people and superior horsemen.
Did you just kind of grow up as a fan of the sport? Is that how it all started for you?
Grew up as a fan of horses, not necessarily a fan of horse racing, but obviously got the bug.
And when you went down to Florida, were you breaking babies, or what was going on down there?
Yeah, breaking babies and taking horses to the sales ring, just general. And then summer was a lot of farm work, building fences and mowing paddocks and the whole nine yards.
Did you have much horse experience when you went to work at Someday Farm, or was it very much a learning curve for you?
It was somewhat of a learning curve. I mean, I had been around some quarter horses, but I'd never been around thoroughbreds, and they're definitely a little bit more high strung and a little bit more aggressive. So yeah, there was a learning curve there, but I picked it up. I had a little knack for it, and I had great teachers.
Yeah, who were some of those people that helped you out in the early days, so to speak?
Well, the single most important person was Frank Myers himself, who was a tremendous horseman, and he really took me under his wings and really gave me an inspiration to be a good horseman and to do things very properly and correctly for the horses, and it had a tremendous influence on me, and even to this day I still believe most of what he taught me.
As you're breaking those babies, explain that process a little bit, because a lot of people hear that expression, but they don't know what it is.
Well, I mean, breaking babies is you have to start with showing them what a bit is in their mouth, and then just that alone, teaching them how to put a bridle on is, it takes a lot of patience and a lot of training, and you have to handle them a lot. And then, of course, after they're broken to the bit, then you have to break them to the saddle. And then after you break them to the saddle, then you got to break them to the rider. And it's a slow process, but patience is important. And, Mr. Myers was tremendous at it. And, of course, just like kids, some are more difficult than others.
Do you remember your most difficult experience with trying to break those babies?
We had one colt. I can't remember who he was by, but we ended up having to put driving reins on him. And Mr. Myers was an old trotting trainer, and they put driving reins on him and walked him around the farm just to teach him, how to turn left and right. And before we could even get a saddle on him, he was a handful.
I remember reading, I think in Preston Birch's book on training, about some people used to break horses to the sulky before they'd break them to a rider. And there might be something to that.
Well, that's where Mr. Myers came up with this solving the problem with this colt, and of course it worked. And that's the kind of horsemanship those old time guys can display. You know, they know all the tricks.
Yeah, I guess that makes you really appreciate the ones that are somewhat docile and do things the way they're supposed to do them. I guess the good kids, if you want to look at them like that. But Tom, it's got to be tremendously rewarding to have a horse that's kind of a problem child like that, and to get him on the straight and narrow, and it's got to be a tremendously rewarding feeling for you.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly deal with that even at the racetrack level, because, you know, they're still they have a big learning curve as two-year-olds when they come to the track, and some are obviously more difficult than others. And when you can get one straightened out and get them to behave in the morning and do the things that they have to do right, if you get them to do it right, it's rewarding, and of course it usually pays off, because when horses train properly in the morning, they usually run well, and when they don't, they usually don't run well.
Have you had a couple of those? I'm sure you have a couple of those success stories with horses that came to you and maybe were a bit unruly, and you did some really good work in getting them to the racetrack and being successful.
Yeah, I mean, it is true that most good horses that turn out to be good horses, they're usually pretty good students. So it's the ones that are extremely difficult, they're not as often to turn into a good horse, but I don't have a specific example in mind, but definitely the good horses, they tend to show their class, and they have a very high intelligence level, and they're very responsive to a lot of what you're trying to do with them. So the good horses they're easier.
Yeah, there's no question about that. One of the things that I always enjoyed was having a horse to saddle that stood there like a statue. I just love that when they're so into the game that they just stand there and let you do your work, saddle them up. I mean, that's just a real pleasure, I think, for a trainer, instead of, you know, trying to dodge getting stepped on or horses acting up rearing in the paddock. And you can definitely tell who's been breaking these horses a lot of times when you get them in and they're all over the place.
Yeah, that's one of my pet peeves. I can't stand it when a horse doesn't behave in a paddock. And I love the horses, the good horses that just stand like statues when you're saddling them, and they're so composed, and you know there's no fear in them, and that is a very special trait. And the few good ones that I've had, they've all been that way. The bad actors in the paddock, they're tough to turn around.
Yeah, once you have a horse like that that continually acts up in the pre-race, is there anything you can do, Tom, as a trainer, to work with that horse and eventually get him to overcome that?
Yeah, I mean, we do school a lot of horses, pre-race. We take him to the paddock and saddle them while other horses are getting saddled for other races. And some horses you might have to take 2 or 3 days a week for a couple of weeks to get them to forget it. And, you know, some of them are always a little bit, tough even after you get them over the hump. But, yeah, there's, you know, some you have to take with the pony. Some you have to saddle on the walk. There's any number of ways to go at it, but we like them to stand and behave and not get too wound up pre-race. And usually the ones that behave, they run better for sure.
You know, Gary Contessa joined us in the first half of the show tonight, and he mentioned that he did not come from a racing background. His family was not into racing. How about you? Did you have family members that were into racing that maybe helped you along the way, or was it a very similar situation to Gary?
Actually, I don't have anyone in my immediate family that's in racing, other than I have a little racing partnership with a couple of my brothers. But no, I had an uncle who was had a, his very best friend was very involved, and that happened to be Mr. Frank Myers, the guy I mentioned before, and that's how I was introduced to Mr. Myers, through my uncle, my mother's brother, and we're very, very close to him even today. He's in his 80s now, and he's the one that introduced me to Frank Myers.
When did you eventually decide that you wanted to become a thoroughbred horse trainer, and what led to that decision?
Well, I went from the horse farm. I was there for 3 years, and then I went from there to Hialeah Park and went to work as a groom on the racetrack. And pretty much from the moment I got to the racetrack, I knew that I wanted to be a trainer, that's for sure.
Who did you work for along the way?
Well, the first trainer I ever worked for was an old-timer named Cy Butler. That was around 1974. And he was a great old school trainer, had actually been an assistant trainer for Green Tree many years ago, and he was a great guy to work for. Mr. Myers actually got me the job with him, and I went to work for him, and then I rubbed horses for Alan Jerkins for a couple of years, and then I became an assistant trainer for Angel Penna Sr., and then I went on my own after being an assistant for Mr. Penna.
Alan Jerkins, of course, one of the greats, Angel Penna Sr. right there as well. Talk about being part of that Alan Jerkins operation, because you talk about being around good horses. Certainly no lack of good horses in that barn.
No, and he's a special person, and obviously a very special trainer. And anyone that's worked for him, anyone, has always been greatly impacted by him. And he was always a great guy to talk to on any level. And if he knew that you took an interest in the horses, he was very fond of you for that. And he was a great guy to work for. I'm very close to his whole family.
Such a great teacher and a very calm and relaxed guy. Somebody like that, you can really learn a lot from.
Yeah, you would hang out with him. That's what you would do. You try to spend as much time with him as you could, and just keep your ears open and watch and listen, and you could learn. And there's nobody better. And he was very exciting to work for. And we had some runs with some horses. It was fun.
Do you still go to him today to ask him maybe some advice, or to talk to him about what's happening with your stable?
No, sometimes I'm mad at him because he's always beaten me. So I don't ask him as much as I used to.
That must be a fun little rivalry, though, isn't it? The student and the teacher.
Oh yeah, I mean they root for you, but they love it when they beat you too. So it's a double-edged sword. But yeah, no, it's we all root for each other. But when we're running against each other, we're rooting for ourselves.
This might be kind of a personal question, but do you play opera music in the barn like Angel Penna Sr. used to do?
No, I don't. But I don't have as sophisticated as horses as he had either.
Trainer Tom Bush, our special guest on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. So was it early 80s, right? I guess around 83 is when you went off on your own. Is that right, Tom?
That's right, yeah.
All right, and how many horses did you have when you first started?
Oh, not many. I don't even remember, but it couldn't have been more than five or six. But yeah, I was. I started out very small, and I had been a foreman for Green Tree before I had went to work for Angel Penna Sr. And I was pretty close with Bob Reinecker, who was the head trainer for Green Tree at the time, and they actually left me a couple of horses during the winter months early on. Those were two of the horses that I had when I first got started.
How long did it take you to get your first winner when you first went out on your own?
I don't think it was long. I know my first winner was a filly named Dancing Lesson, but I can't remember actually how long it was, but it wasn't a long, long time.
We're just impressed that you remembered the name of your first winner. You wouldn't believe how many trainers come on the show and can't remember.
You got to remember that one.
Yeah, it's really surprising to us that a lot of trainers can't remember that. I mean, I'm glad that you did. That's a feather in your cap, really.
Yeah.
Tom, talk about some of the horses that you've been privileged to have come through your barn over the years, some of the ones that really stand out to you.
Well, I had a very nice horse in the mid-80s named Exclusive Partner. And we ended up selling him after winning a couple of stakes with him, and I received a commission for that as well. So I bought my first house with that horse. So that horse is always, he'll always have a warm spot. But he was a very, very nice grass horse. We bought him privately. Paul Kornman was the owner of the horse, who was a very, very bright handicapper. And he picked him out, and we developed him into a nice horse and sold him to R.D. Hubbard in California. And he went on and won some more races for Dick Mandela.
He, of course, was not the only nice horse to come through your barn. We'll talk about Get Stormy because we're going to get to him in a minute. But before Get Stormy, kind of in between those two, who were some of the others?
Well, I had two very nice New York Reds just a few years back. I had a horse named Golden Roses who was more of a sprinter, but he did win a couple of nice races going long. But he was more of a sprinter, but he made $800,000 or $900,000, and he won a bunch of races for us. And he was a very, very nice gold, real nice gold. And we had, of course, the old timer Bandrock, who was a real good New York Red grass horse, and got the champion grass horse and older horse for New York Reds a couple of years. And he won a lot of races for us. And he was real, real nice horse to be around. And he had a sister named Atlantia that we won some nice races with as well. So those have been pretty nice horses. And my last nice horse was Unbridled Command, which he was sold this winter. And that was a tough loss for the stable, but that's what the owners sometimes need to do.
Yeah, he went to Great Britain, is that correct?
The horse did go to England, yes.
Have you kept up with him at all?
I have not. I don't think the horse has run yet, and I don't know where he's at in his training at the present time. But I haven't followed him religiously. But I don't think the horse has made a start in Europe yet.
Tom, you mentioned the old timer Bandrock. How long? What age did he race until?
I think we ran him until he was eight, and he only ran maybe a time or two when he was eight. But he had very good years at five and six, and he did pretty well at seven too. But he was very, very consistent, and he usually had to pack a weight, and you know, he was pretty unbeatable if the turf came up soft. And he was very fortunate on a number of occasions to get the kind of ground he really excelled on. So, but he was a real very, very nice horse to be around, and very great clients. One of the owners of Bandrock is 99 years old today, and she still watches TVG, and I have one filly in training for her right now, and I'm hoping to win a race for her, and she keeps telling me to hurry up.
Good advice. Yeah. We could all take that advice, by the way. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Let's go to Get Stormy, and let's talk about Get Stormy. This is a horse that brought you really so much success, and he was such a consistent horse, such a hard trier. Tell us the story behind Get Stormy.
Well, he's owned by Sullimar Stable, which is Mary Sullivan. She's been a breeder and an owner for 25 years or more. P.G. Johnson was her only trainer for many, many years before he passed away. And I was fortunate enough to be recommended to her by Tom Roach at Parrish Hill Farm. And I've been training for her ever since. And her and her husband, Bob, are very, very special people. We're very close to them. And obviously we had such on success with Get Stormy, and he's now doing very well in his first year at stud. So he's still a part of the family.
Do you ever have a chance to go see him when you're in Kentucky?
Oh, I've seen him already three or four times since he went home last November.
Yeah, they really do become like your kids, don't they?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he was he he was a special horse to be around, and a special horse to train. And you know, on his best day, he was a very nice horse.
You know, people often miss the true human element of this game, and I guess the compassion of this game. And I'm curious, Tom, when you have a horse like Get Stormy or even Ban Rock, who became so close to you, how difficult is it when they leave your barn and you have to say goodbye?
It's tough. I mean, in Get Stormy's case, it was not nearly as tough as, say, like when I lost a horse like Unbridled Command to a private sale. But Get Stormy, we knew he was going to go to another job, and we were excited about his future. So that was easier. And as it turns out, he's doing extremely well. Has really acclimated to being a stallion, and he bred over 117 mares this year. So we're just doing everything we can to give him a chance to make it as a stallion.
There's a certain amount of joy in retiring a horse after a nice career, because you're happy for the horse, and they're going to go on to either be a stallion or a broodmare or find some other career. And I think most trainers really enjoy that aspect of it. It's like a job well done.
Yeah, it's not often that a horse is good enough to possibly have a career as a stallion, because you know, our business is tougher now. A mediocre kind of racehorse, they're very tough to spot. And you know, when you get one that is good enough to, you know, at least have a chance at stud, it's exciting. And you know, we can't wait to see some Get Stormy babies, and hopefully they're going to look something like him. And if they do, we're going to be in pretty good shape.
And I guess you'll be first in line to raise your hand at the auction to get a couple of those?
I hope so.
There you go. You're taking applications from owners now, huh?
Exactly. We're anxious to see his first babies next year, so we'll be going around looking at them when they get on the ground.
Trainer Tom Bush, our special guest on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Tom, spend a few minutes talking about your philosophy as a trainer. You mentioned Frank Myers, you mentioned Alan Jerkins, Angel Pena Sr., being around those individuals. Talk about your philosophy as you condition these horses.
Well, I mean, I think any trainer takes a lot from the people that he did work for. He doesn't do everything like they did, but he takes the things that fit his style and incorporating into his own style. And I mean, I'm pretty I mean, the modern trainers the horses do seem to be more fragile, so we're not as aggressive with them, and we don't race them as much, and we don't train them as hard as the old timers did. But I think I'm very good with patience, and I'm very good with not pushing a horse until they're ready for it. And I've been fortunate enough to develop a few horses from the time they were very young into nice horses. And I think that's the real joy, is when you get them when they're babies, and over a period of 3 or 4 years, you turn them into something real productive. Why, that's a good feeling.
Yeah, you mentioned the word patience, and that's kind of been a recurring theme when we talk to the various trainers on this program week in and week out. You have to be patient if you're going to have success in this game, don't you?
Yeah, I mean, it's tougher and tougher to do that, too, because, you know, our expenses are astronomical, and the owners are paying some big-time bills, and, you know, there's pressure on you to get the horses to perform. But the horses have to tell you when they're ready. And I'm any good trainer, and there are many, many, many good trainers in New York that I have a great deal of respect for, and every one of them is patient. That is one trait that you must have if you're going to really have success and be able to develop a horse into something.
You got to tell your 99-year-old client to cool her jets a little bit.
yep. That's it.
Tom, what is on the Tom Bush bucket list of things that you want to accomplish, maybe that you haven't done yet that you're still looking to do?
I mean, I don't know that I have one. I just I want to continue to have success, and I want to get better horses in my barn. I'm constantly trying to improve the quality. It's not so much the numbers. It's not the quantity. It's the quality, and it's hard to come up with good horses. But I love what I'm doing, and I hope to be doing it for a lot longer.
You know, we always have fun at the end of the interview. We always like to ask trainers what they do when they're not at the racetrack and what other hobbies that they do have. What other things does Tom Bush like to do?
I don't have any other hobbies.
That's a popular answer.
So many trainers tell us that, Tom. It's just, this is your life.
Yeah, it is. It's more of a lifestyle. It is a job, but it's a lifestyle as well, and that's the way it has to be, actually.
Tom Bush, our special guest here on Trainer Talk. Tom, we can't thank you enough for being with us here tonight. Always fun to catch up and hear your story as well. Great stuff, and thanks so much for taking the time.
Appreciate the call, you guys.
All right, Tom Bush. Amazing. We sit here week in and week out, Jude, and we do these interviews and we talk to these trainers, and everybody has their own unique story. And, you know, Gary Contessa in the first half of the program has his story, which is remarkable. And then Tom, a completely different way of getting to this top level profession. It's amazing.
Yeah. And there's still common threads, you know, both guys we had on tonight. And it's amazing how we pair these things up out of the air. You know, we don't like schedule it, but here's two guys that neither one came from horse families. Both of them loved horses. They didn't really know anything about racing, but they just like being around the animals. And that was the common thread that runs through tonight's show.
Yeah.
You can get there. You don't have to be born on a farm. You don't have to, you know, inherit your horses from your mother and father or whatever. You can do it on your own.
And I know you can respect that because you've told me multiple times when you trained horses for, 20 years in California, the one thing that really appealed to you and the one constant throughout your career was the love of the horse.
Yeah, I mean, I was a lot like Contessa mentioned. I mean, I think we were probably closer because we were from big cities, but, you know, I used to wear cowboy hat and chaps everywhere. You know, I loved horses. I loved the Lone Ranger, all of those things. And you know,
Did he say chaps, Sean? I think he did, didn't he?
Yeah. The only place you could...
That visual is never going to get out. I'm not going to sleep tonight.
I wore them over my pants. And the only place you could see horses was at the track. And I was a paddock rat. I used to hang out in the paddock. And my uncle, these guys, both their uncles took him to the track. My uncle Neil, he taught me how to check horses for bandages and check equipment. He used to keep records of it. He was very astute about that, and he taught me that part of the game. And I used to love standing there at Santa Anita watching trainers saddle horses and just think to myself, oh, someday I want to do that.
Yeah.
You know, and I was so lucky. The first time I ever put the saddle on a horse at Santa Anita, he won. It was my first winner. And it was surreal. I mean, it was freakish to be able to do that after wanting to do it from the time, I started going to the track when I was 3.
Yeah.
So, and I had my first winner, I think, I think I was like 24 or something like that. So, you know, it was like amazing. My whole life I wanted to do that. And the first time I did it, I came to the winner's circle.
Yeah, just to get to that point. It's something that is a goal that you set out to accomplish, just like Gary Contessa, just like Tom Bush, and I think maybe even more like Gary, because he was truly passionate about it. He had that burning desire, and he had a goal, an objective, and he went after it, and he got it.
Yeah, and I used to talk to trainers all the time. I mean, I was so lucky to be around those kind of guys like Laz Barrera and Buster Milrick, Bobby Frankel, Charlie Whittingham, Noble Threewit. These are guys that were legends in the game and always willing to help you. And I don't know if the trainers are like that anymore.
You can catch a podcast of Trainer Talk each and every week on our website. All of our Trainer Talk shows are archived for you to listen at your leisure, horseracingradio.net. This show will be available shortly as well. And, of course, you can always catch us on iTunes, Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. We are back tomorrow, 3 to 6, with our live racing coverage, and 6 to 7 tomorrow night with the BristNet.com call-in show. And on Friday, of course, 3 to 7, and our final furlong show from 6 to 7 is the Express Bet Weekend Stakes Preview. See a schedule on our website, horseracingradio.net. For our producer, Sean C., Jude Feld, I'm Mike Pena. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk on HRN.
Good night, Barbados.